New foreign minister, the same clerical regime, I guess, but the officials in front are different. Are they taking a different approach?
Well, so far, President Raisi is highlighting a difficult condition that he says Washington has to agree to, and that's a guarantee the U.S. isn't going to pull out of any new deal the way Donald Trump did with the 2015 accord. The Americans say, well, we can't really guarantee that we can bind the hands of a future U.S. president. So if these talks do gain momentum and get back on track, it will be interesting to watch Raisi's attitude toward reaching a deal with the outside world as that prospect comes closer to becoming a reality.
How does the rest of the world fit in? And by the rest of the world, I mean the other world powers that were part of this agreement and remain part of the agreement.
Right. The UK, France, Germany, Russia, China, they also have an interest in verifiable limits on Iran's nuclear program, and they will be talking directly with Iran. The U.S. delegation, as you alluded to, will be in a different room because it's not part of the deal right now. One of the biggest concerns, of course, lack of access for UN nuclear inspectors. Even camera footage has been inaccessible at least one site. Another concern is that Tehran is latching onto this whole issue of verification for its own purposes. It's now saying we want to be able to verify that sanctions have been fully lifted, and then we'll think about fulfilling our commitments. No one knows how long that might take if that's agreed to.
Can each side look at this and at least say it is in our interest for the United States to get back into this deal? On a basic level, does it seem to be in each side's interest?
Well, in theory, absolutely yes. The U.S. and all the international partners want limits on Iran's nuclear program. Iran's got to have its economy out from under the pain of economic sanctions. It's seen protests in several cities. People are really tired of chronic shortages, high prices, but diplomats say time is running out, and it's a very worrying steps that are happening, and critics are continuing to say increased pressure is the best response. We'll see what happens with these talks on Monday.
Peter, it's always a pleasure to get your insights. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
That's NPR's Peter Kenyon in Istanbul. Now, the U.S. envoy in the negotiations with Iran is Rob Malley. Before this round of talks, he traveled to visit Iran's neighbors. He went to Israel, along with Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Bahrain. Now, when Malley spoke with us, he said those Persian Gulf and other countries offered Iran a choice, and he put their message this way.
There are two paths forward. One path is a return to the deal, in which case we, countries of the Gulf, are prepared to expand our diplomatic and our economic ties, which is what they say they want to do, integrate the region economically and diplomatically. But if you don't go back into the deal, if you continue to escalate and to increase your nuclear advances, then that door will be shut. Iran will once again become the cause of a non-proliferation crisis.
And that is the message that Malley hopes to bring to next week's negotiations in Vienna. He says Arab nations that once doubted the nuclear agreement are ready for the U.S. to return to it.
I'm not going to say they fell in love with the deal, but they recognize the reality that the alternative to the deal, which is no deal or no American participation in the deal, which means that Iran has left its own commitments, has meant an increased nuclear program and more aggressive Iranian regional behavior. And I think all of the countries of the Gulf, and some of them have different assessments of the merits of the deal, but they all agree that getting back in the deal is critical now, and they offered Iran those two paths.
Israel openly opposed the deal and openly welcomed President Trump leaving the deal, but now has a new government. Has Israel's attitude changed?
So I won't hide that Israel still remains opposed to the deal, although I think there's some nuances in the public debate, including former Israeli officials who say withdrawing from the deal was a big mistake. I think they would prefer that we not rejoin the deal, but at the same time, they've made clear they don't want to have public differences with us. They understand that if we go back in the deal, they won't try to stop it. If that happens, they want us to work together on what happens after we're back in the deal. And if we don't get back in the deal, if Iran is not prepared, they want us to work closely, which of course we want to do as well.
Just about a year ago, an Iranian nuclear scientist was assassinated. Israel, rightly or wrongly, was blamed for that assassination. Did it set back your efforts to have an Iranian scientist assassinated just as a new president was preparing to try to resume this nuclear deal?
So I don't want to get into details of what may or may not have happened in Iran. I mean, our focus is on diplomacy, seeing whether we could get back into the deal and then build on it. But if not, if Iran chooses, and it really is at this point, I think, an Iranian choice, if they choose not to go back into the deal, then obviously we're going to have to see other efforts, diplomatic and otherwise, to try to address Iran's nuclear ambitions.
Diplomatic and otherwise.
Well, I mean, economic and otherwise. I mean, I think the President Biden has made clear, as has Secretary Blinken, that we privilege diplomacy. And I think we've made clear now, and I think you and I have spoken several times about this, that we're prepared to get back into the deal and to lift all of the sanctions that are inconsistent with the deal. So if Iran wants to get back into the deal, it has a way to do that. If it doesn't want to get back into the deal, if it continues to do what it appears to be doing now, which is to drag its feet at the nuclear diplomatic table and accelerate its pace when it comes to its nuclear program, if that's the path it chooses, we'll have to respond accordingly. And so we've gone through this before, so the options that are at America's disposal are familiar to all.
When we last sat in this office talking, Iran's old government was still in place. The old president was still in office, the old foreign minister, the old nuclear negotiator. Now a new president who is seen as more conservative, more skeptical of the United States, or maybe I should say even more skeptical of the United States, has taken office. How has that changed your position?
So it hasn't changed our position. I think what remains to be seen, how has it changed Iran's position? If one judges by what Iran has done, continue to expand its nuclear program, what it hasn't done, which is come back to the table. We're only coming back on Monday, so it's been 5 months since the last time we met. And what it's been saying, which is taking very hardline positions about their demands, that doesn't augur well for the talk. So let's see what they say when they're at the table. But obviously the indications they've given, and we're not the only ones who've heard those indications, are not particularly encouraging. So Russia, China, the U.S., Germany, France, and the U.K. all are in agreement. Let's get back into the deal. Let's do it by closing the remaining issues that were left open in June after six rounds of talks. But let's hurry up because time is not on our side. And I have to emphasize this. Given the pace of Iran's nuclear advances, we don't have much time before we have to conclude that Iran has chosen a different path.
I think you know very well one of the critiques of trying to get back into the deal, which is that at some point it expires. We're 6 years into the deal. Some of the provisions were only supposed to last 10 years. You're still not in the deal. It's going to take some more time. Is there still a point in getting back into this deal?
Well, listen, by withdrawing from the deal, we have brought that crisis much closer to us. I mean, when people, the deal, some of its provisions lasted 10 years, some 15, some 20, some 25, some never expired. The complete, I would say irony, but it's a tragedy of the decision to withdraw from the deal is that it's brought all of those future problems much closer to home. See, our goal was when we negotiated the deal to succeed in implementing the deal, building a modicum of trust, I wouldn't even go that far, but some sense that both sides can live up to their commitments, and then build on it to address the many, many other issues that we have with Iran, including aspects of their nuclear program. That was what we were hoping to do. The problem is, by withdrawing from the deal, we're sitting now, you and I, talking about issues that had been dealt with in 2016, rather than on building on the achievement of the nuclear deal to try to address issues that we have with Iran and, frankly, that Iran has with us.
How will the talks in Vienna work?
Well, we'll be in one hotel room and we'll be waiting to hear what others, those who Iran agrees to talk to, will report back. So this is not exactly the way it should be. And we have repeatedly said to Iran indirectly, since they won't listen to us directly, that if they want to get results, if they want to get quicker results, the better way is to sit face to face with us.
Rob Malley, U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, spoke earlier this week. Tomorrow on Weekend Edition, what's gone wrong in Honduras? Carrie Kahn investigates a country where poverty and corruption drive migration toward the United States. Tell your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Hannah Haynes in for Melissa Ingalls today. Coming up today, shoppers are already close to a record spending year. On this Black Friday, we'll go to a more unconventional shopping location, one known as the Macy's of the North. That Wisconsin life in 25 minutes.
On the next Fresh Air, Stanley Tucci. He's known for his roles in films like Big Night, The Devil Wears Prada, and The Lovely Bones. He hosted a series about Italian cooking on CNN, and he has a new memoir about culinary treasures in his life and about temporarily losing his sense of taste while getting treated for oral cancer. Join us.
You can hear Fresh Air at 7 o'clock here on WPR.
Support for WPR comes from many small businesses. Saturday, November 27th is Small Business Saturday, a day that encourages the support of local retailers and restaurants who need community support more than ever, both in-store and online.
Support for WGTD comes from the law offices of Frank J. Parise, helping serve criminal defense needs, including traffic and DUIs, for over 35 years. Call 262-656-9906 for more info.
Partly to mostly cloudy skies today in Wisconsin. Light winds, lower temperatures, especially this morning, single digits and upper teens. It'll warm up throughout the day, highs in the mid-20s to mid-30s overall for this Friday, and then some light snow tomorrow. Northern areas of the state could see 1 to 4 inches.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Simon & Schuster, publishers of The American Experiment, Dialogues on a Dream by David M. Rubenstein, the story of the nation as an experiment in democracy, culture, and ideas, available wherever books are sold. From C3 AI, C3 AI software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable problems. C3 AI. This is Enterprise AI. And from Klaviyo, working to help brands deliver personalized email and SMS campaigns that drive revenue and create genuine customer relationships at klaviyo.com/NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. At the end of this month, France gives a special honor to Josephine Baker. The remains of the singer will be moved to the Paris Pantheon. That's the French Mausoleum of Heroes. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports on why the American singer has found a place alongside Victor Hugo and Marie Curie.
In J'ai deux amours, Josephine Baker's most iconic song, she sings of having two loves, my country and Paris. Born into a poor family in St. Louis, Missouri, Baker arrived in the French capital in 1925 to be part of an all-black dance show. She was just 19 years old. Writer Laurent Kupferman's documentary, Josephine Baker, A French Destiny, airs next week. He says Baker's love affair with France began when she got off the train in Paris.
And someone gave the hand to help her. And that person was a white person. And she felt so good that she was seen not as a color, but as a human person.
Baker performed in an all-black show called La Revue Nègre, often dancing half-nude in her iconic banana belt. It was heavily stereotypical and in line with European conceptions at the time of non-whites as erotic and funny. But Baker managed to have her own agency, says historian Pap Ndiaye.
She, in fact, mocked these stereotypes. She was not taking things at face value, and she made sure that everyone understood she was not exactly what people expected her to be. And this was quite an accomplishment for a very young woman who didn't have much knowledge of the society she landed in.
Baker's French was soon fluent, and she began to sing. The little girl who had cleaned houses at the age of 9 in St. Louis became a star in Paris and part of the city's intellectual and artistic elite of the 1930s. In 1936, Baker took her show to the U.S., but her success didn't translate. And after living in France, she could no longer bear Jim Crow laws and the systemic racism of her own country. In 1937, Baker became a French citizen. She bought a chateau in the bucolic Dordogne region of France.
We are in the house of Josephine.
Today, that chateau is owned by 45-year-old Angélique de Saint-Exupéry, who grew up hearing stories of Baker and could see her chateau from her own bedroom window as a young girl. Saint-Exupéry has spent the last 20 years refurbishing the Chateau de Miland to pay homage to Josephine Baker. Today, it's a national historical monument visited by more than 100,000 people a year.
Yes, it's my present for Josephine. Josephine adopted 12 children. She fought against racism during all her life. She fought during the Second War. She is an extraordinary woman.
Scouring auctions, Saint-Exupéry has collected photos, furniture, playbills, and dresses from Baker's life.
Here it's she wore in the Carnegie Hall in New York.
In 1940, after the German invasion, Baker permanently left Paris for Les Milandes, refusing to perform for the Nazis.
Eh bien, elle cache des réfugiés. Donc on
Saint-Exupéry explains how Baker hid resistance fighters, Jewish refugees, and guns in her chateau. She sang for French troops and undertook espionage missions, risking her life for her adopted country. Baker was awarded medals for her valor, and in 1961 she was decorated with the Legion of Honor medal.
In my homeland where I was born and love and respect, I'm glad to see this day come to pass.
In 1963, she addressed Martin Luther King's March on Washington, dressed in her French Resistance uniform with medals across her breast.
Bonjour.
Georges Pasquet was just 20 years old when he became Josephine Baker's head butler at the chateau in the 1960s. Today, at 81, he thinks back fondly on those times. He even has a picture of Baker on his flip phone.
C'était très luxueux et sortant de mon...
It was such a luxurious and fabulous place, and coming from my little village, I was stunned by it all, he says. She had such energy and never slept. She'd call me down from my room at 4 a.m. and say, George, let's go over the plans for the day. I'd come in my robe. I didn't have time to dress. Pasquet also helped care for the 12 children Baker adopted from all over the world. Her rainbow tribe. I meet Baker's seventh child, Brian Bouillon Baker, inside the Pantheon, where his mother will soon be laid to rest. He says she adopted him from Algeria during the country's war of independence with France and changed his life.
She wanted to show that coming from different parts of the world, with different religions and different countries and culture, that it was possible to be brothers, to have a kind of universal brotherhood. It was like a demonstration to the world.
Baker collapsed after her last concert in Paris at the age of 68 and died several days later. Thousands of Parisians lined the streets for her funeral in 1975. Because of her mounting debts, she had been unable to keep her chateau. Historian Pap Ndiaye says Baker may have made mistakes in her personal life, but when it came to important issues, she always made the right choices.
Human rights, the Second World War, the fight against segregation, racism, fascism, she was right on target.
And for that, Josephine Baker will become the first artist, first woman of color, and first American to be honored in France's Pantheon. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Rappelle-toi, Paris. Quand j'ai chanté, j'ai deux amours. J'avais fait le Paris.
This is NPR News.
So how will we tackle the next pandemic? Hundreds of countries are gathering next week to try to create binding rules for future outbreaks.
Everybody has seen to what extent we were really disorganized and all have seen the failures in the global system.
I'm Audie Cornish. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
News is next. We'll hear about a mentorship program at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. More on that after news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. There are fresh worries about a new strain of COVID-19 identified in South Africa. In a briefing, UK Health Secretary Sajid Javid said that new travel restrictions are going into effect for a handful of African nations because of the new viral variant.
We have not detected any of this new variant in the UK at this point in time, but we've always been clear that we will take action to protect the progress that we have made.
Amid a resurgence of COVID infections in the 27-nation bloc, the European Union is planning to stop air travel from southern Africa to counter the spread of the new variant, German Health Minister Jens Spahn calling it, quote, the last thing we need. Black Friday in-store shopping is back, says Catherine Cullen at the National Retail Federation.
Shoppers associate Black Friday, Thanksgiving weekend with great deals. So that's also a motivator for them. We also know that for gifts, people like shopping in stores for gifts because it lets them touch and feel a product, see it in person.
She's forecasting a growth in retail sales of as much as 10.5%. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was set to open sharply lower. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Hannah Haynes. The University of Wisconsin-Green Bay is turning to upperclassmen to mentor new arrivals and high school students thinking about college. Rich Kramer reports it's an effort to make students of color feel more connected to campus.
Hannah Beauchamp-Pope is a junior at UW-Green Bay, majoring in psychology. She's one of several mentors in a new program called BIPOC Rise. The program focuses on new and potential college students of color at the predominantly white institution. Beauchamp-Pope is connecting with students at Green Bay's Preble High School on a weekly basis.
The goal is to encourage them and motivate them to see that college is doable and that they have the power to achieve that.
Beauchamp-Pope says other mentors are working to ensure freshmen of color at the college can build connections with peers and a sense of belonging. She says those who don't can be more likely to drop out before their second year. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Injuries from guns requiring hospital care are on the rise in Dane County. UW Health's Trauma Center treated 42 patients for gun injuries last year and could see that many or more this year. Dr. Ann O'Rourke is medical director at the Trauma Center. She says the injuries are both emotional and physical.
Even if patients survive, you know, it's not like the movies where you just get winged and somebody puts a Band-Aid on your arm and you sit with a blanket over your shoulder in the ambulance and then get to go home.
She said the effects of gun violence can be long-lasting, with detrimental effects not only for the victim, but the community. The Trauma Center also partners with a community group called Focused Interruption that seeks to prevent violence. The Green Bay Packers have sold more than $41 million worth of stock in just over a week. It's the sixth stock offering in franchise history. The team said Wednesday it had sold more than 138,000 shares of stock at $300 a share. The NFL's only community-owned club last offered stock 10 years ago. WLUK-TV reports that more than half of the 300,000 shares being offered remain available. The stock sale is set to run until February 25th, unless all available shares are sold before that. Packers leaders say they will use the money to fund upgrades to Lambeau Field, including new video boards. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Jipaygo, committed to delivering transformative healthcare solutions for women and families. Jipaygo believes that where a woman lives should not determine if she lives. More at jhpiego.org. And from Oliver Wyman, believing business success is a series of everyday decisions shaped by breakthrough moments, requiring expertise, creativity, and diversity of ideas and people. Learn more at oliverwyman.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. It is Black Friday. And if you're wondering if this year we're shopping more than ever before, you are correct. The holiday shopping season is expected to set a new record despite all the shipping problems, hiring struggles, and, of course, the ongoing pandemic. NPR's business correspondent Alina Selyuk is here to tell us more, and I'm very happy to be joining the annual tradition of asking you the same question. Is Black Friday still a thing? So is it still a thing?
It depends on what you mean by that. If you mean people lining up in tents outside of a local Best Buy at dawn, well, maybe not so much. People shopping like crazy is definitely still a thing. The National Retail Federation says Black Friday is still the day when the most number of people shop, even more than on Cyber Monday, although, of course, both of them are huge for online shopping. But let's be real, Black Friday sales have been going on for months. What is it, October, September, maybe the summer? I talked to Katerina Grant from Maryland, who says she bought almost all her gifts on summer sales. Legos for her 7-year-old son and Barbie toys for her 4-year-old daughter.
We bought the huge Barbie dream house. The price is more expensive now than when I got it at Costco randomly in, I think, maybe August. So I don't know. The price is more expensive or the same by like $20.
She shopped early and she has no regrets.
No, why would I want to keep my sneaker shelves fresh, so why not? So how good are the deals this year?
I mean, they are there. Adobe tracks online shopping, and that group says it's been roughly 20% off toys, 15% off clothes, 13% off computers. They are predicting best deals today on furniture, tools, and home goods, and a bit better deals on electronics and appliances tomorrow on Saturday, and then TVs on Cyber Monday. But overall, this year's holiday discounts indeed are not expected to be as good as maybe we've seen in years past, sort of what Grant noticed. You mentioned the shipping mess, the hiring issues. Both of those are costing retailers a pretty penny, billions of dollars. So this year, they're not really willing and able to offer those super generous blowout sales like we might have seen in the past.
And then on top of that, inflation has kicked in at the highest level since 1990 as of last month. So why aren't higher prices maybe deterring holiday shoppers?
This is a peculiar thing. In surveys, people say they're really worried about inflation. So-called consumer sentiment is actually at a decade low. But then people also keep buying stuff, you know, paying those higher prices. Spending and sentiment, sort of how we feel and what we actually do, normally they go hand in hand in sync, but not this year. Adobe says on Thanksgiving Day, just online, shoppers were spending $3.5 million a minute. So as far as inflation worries, maybe people are more worried about the future rather than the now. And it's also worth pointing out some of the biggest price jumps have been for food and gas, which are not really the kind of thing you buy as a holiday gift.
No, and how will people know that I love them unless I spend on them? I mean, that's the whole point, right?
Now, okay, and how would you put gas in a stocking?
Right, impossible. I mean, it smells. Now, when we talk about record shopping, are we spending more simply because just things are more expensive?
No, I mean, it's definitely part of it, but economists I've talked to say we are looking at a record, even if all the numbers were adjusted for inflation. It's really hard to overstate just how much shopping people have been doing all year long. That's kind of at the heart of most of the challenges we've been hearing about this year, the log jams in ports, the overwhelmed warehouses, overrun trucks, the shipping delays. As early as the spring, we were buying so much that it was like holiday shopping levels of stuff. And that's because all that sitting at home last year, plus federal aid, gave people lots of cash. Here's economist Tim Quinlan from Wells Fargo.
Think of the vacations that have been canceled, the weddings that have been put off, the kids that didn't go to camp. And that leads to this excess savings that's kind of found its way into mostly goods spending.
And that's how we're looking at a holiday gift buying season of $850 billion. That's possibly as much as 10% more than last year, which already was the biggest year of all. So at this point, even the Grinch couldn't stop 2021 from becoming a massive record-breaking shopping year.
Yeah, not a chance. That's NPR's business correspondent, Alina Selyuk. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Some other news now. A Tennessee man who spent more than 30 years on death row has been spared from execution. A new state law lets Purvis Payne challenge his sentence for a crime he says he did not commit. He can challenge it because he is intellectually disabled. Here's Samantha Max of our member station WPLN.
When Purvis Payne walked into a Memphis courtroom on Tuesday morning, he hugged his attorney and sobbed as local TV cameras recorded. Payne has waited more than 3 decades for this moment. He's been on death row since 1988 for a stabbing that killed a young woman and her daughter and wounded her son. Payne says he didn't do it, that he found the family on his way to visit his girlfriend who lived in an apartment across the hall. He says he tried to help the victims. But then Payne realized police might suspect him, a young black man, of stabbing the white family. So he fled. Police arrested him shortly after. Payne's sister, Rolanda Holman, was just 13 when he went to trial.
I remember the judge sentencing him to death by way of the electric chair. And then he said, "May God have mercy on his soul." So I'm grateful for 34 years later that God did have mercy on his soul.
This week, a judge vacated Payne's death sentence thanks to a new Tennessee law that allows people on death row with intellectual disabilities to ask for a lesser sentence. Payne's attorneys pushed for the legislation, noting that both the state and federal Supreme Courts had ruled people with intellectual disabilities shouldn't be executed. A recent evaluation found Payne fit those criteria. So last week, prosecutors dropped their fight for the death penalty.
What a difference it makes to be able to wake up in the morning and not have to feel like you have to fight for your life.
That's Payne's attorney, Kelly Henry. She's the one who held him in court as he cried. It was a rare moment of relief for an attorney who is the last line of defense for more than half of Tennessee's death row. The past few years have been particularly tough for her. After a nearly decade-long hiatus, the state executed 7 people in a year and a half. 2 were her clients. The federal government also carried out a spate of executions near the end of the Trump administration. Henry contracted COVID while trying to prevent one.
I fear that Tennessee could be like the federal government in 2022 and 2023 with execution after execution.
The state has 3 executions on the books for next year. But judges have also overturned 2 of her clients' death sentences this month. Henry is grateful for this moment, but she is still determined to prove Payne's innocence.
Justice does not come through the execution of an innocent man or the incarceration of an innocent man.
Prosecutors will no longer pursue the death sentence, but they're standing by Payne's conviction. So he won't be leaving prison, at least not now. For NPR News, I'm Samantha Max.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Hannah Haynes. Still to come, another documentary on the Beatles. Is it any good? In about 10 minutes, a look at the new docuseries called The Beatles Get Back. NPR music critic Ann Powers has the review. That's coming up.
I am Dory Black, formerly of Delavan, and I donated my blue 2001 Dodge Dakota Sport to Wisconsin Public Radio. When we decided to move to North Carolina to be closer to our grandsons, I decided I would donate my aging truck to WPR. It was 20 years old, and it probably would not have made it through the mountains. It was hard to let go of my trusty truck, but I knew it was going to a good cause.
Find out how you can donate at WPR.org/vehicle. Thank you.
Support for WPR comes from Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, offering bird food, feeders, and nature gifts. In-store and curbside pickup Tuesday through Saturday, 8402 Old Sauk Road, Madison. Wild Birds Unlimited.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. Honor a life well-lived with a gift of a service for burial or cremation with a professional, friendly, and compassionate staff. Serving the community for 90 years. Piasecki Funeral Home.
You're listening to WPR. Today is Native American Heritage Day, and WPR's classical hosts are sharing music to honor the day, including a violin concerto called Trail of Tears and a piece for Native American flute and orchestra. Listen between 9 until 3 today here on WPR. Taking a look at the weather forecast, cloudy today, light winds. It'll be cold this morning, highs in the single digits and upper teens, but then it'll warm up throughout the day, highs in the mid-20s to mid-30s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fidelity. With Fidelity Income Planning, Fidelity looks at how much clients saved, how much they'll need, and helps them build a plan for cash flow so they can go from saving to living. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And from Total Wine & More, whose top 20 wines of the year list can help find a gift or a holiday menu item. Total Wine & More. In-store, online, or on the app. Spirits not available in Virginia or North Carolina.
Good morning. This is WPR, and it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the Macy's of the North.
A thrift shop in Wisconsin's Northwoods is a stark contrast to the Black Friday scene. Jane Hampton takes us to the store in Minocqua, where deals on clothing, cabin decor, and all kinds of stuff draw bargain hunters from far and wide.
Minocqua is a tourist town, but the cute little gift stores are blocks away from the St. Matthias Thrift Shop. It's a plain brick rectangle that used to be a public service building. On a drizzly morning, dozens of shoppers are lined up before doors open at 10.
Why are you waiting in line in the rain?
Because it's totally worth it.
What's a lucky find?
My best lucky find was a set of dishes. They were like brand new, sold for $100. I got them for $12.
I'm looking for shoes that fit, and socks.
Finally, the store manager, Jan Degner, unlocks the door.
Are you ready?
Yes!
All right, be nice to each other and have a good time.
Okay.
Degner's a little nervous about this day. It's the big dollar-a-bag event when shoppers pay a buck for whatever they can jam into a brown paper grocery bag. The shop gets chaotic.
I'm very particular about how it looks out on the floor so that it doesn't look junky, so that things look well-arranged like a regular store. Some people call it the Macy's of the North.
The Macy's of the North definitely has a woodsy vibe. Degner's husband, Gene, runs the furniture side of things.
If it's an upholstered chair and it has animals on it like deer and bear, they love that.
Loons, deer heads. Those and fish mounds are very popular. I think people like to put them up and say they caught them.
Today, though, the hot sellers are dishes, clothing, and toys.
Like, I love to thrift shop. It's thrilling, to be honest.
Winona Careful of Lac de Flambeau has four girls under eight, and the St. Matthias Thrift Shop helps with the budget.
My daughters all have birthdays within about a month of each other, too, so it's a tough time of year.
There's nobody in this neck of the woods that should not have boots, not have a coat, not have furniture.
Barbara Dirksen is one of dozens of local volunteers. She and Degner sift through mountains of donations, everything from junk to gems.
One of our volunteers was going through a bunch of socks that came in, opened up one of the socks, and there was a diamond ring in it. You'll find some that have engraving inside, happy anniversary, and those kind of things. Those are sad. There's many a time we've stood out there in the back room and teared up with family members and hugged, and, you know, there's a lot of personal things going on, too.
What happens is when people sell their cottages, they sell it with all the stuff in it because they don't want it. They don't want to take it home to Chicago. They don't want it. And so now new people buy that house. They don't want that stuff, and it used to go in the dump, and it comes here, and it's perfectly good stuff. They just don't want it. It's not their stuff.
It's a cliche. One person's trash is another one's treasure, but it adds up to big bucks at the thrift shop.
Last year, we gave away $470,000.
The shop gives 10% to the church for outreach and 90% to the community. Dozens of local organizations got grants last year, and yes, they totaled nearly $500,000.
I found it was like a glass goose, and it looked pretty cool.
Are there some clothes in that bag for you?
Yes, a lot.
The thrift store is open all winter, along with a special Christmas shop for the holiday season.
Thank you.
Hey, bye-bye, baby.
Bye.
Bye.
See you later.
Jane Hampton teaches journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and brought us that story on the St. Matthias Thrift Shop in Minocqua. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lake Lawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lake Lawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakeLawnResort.com.
From 9 to 3 weekdays. For our complete classical music schedule, including weekend and overnight offerings, visit WPR.org.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to WPR on this Friday. I'm Hannah Haynes. In sports, the Milwaukee Bucks will look to extend their win streak tonight when they play the Denver Nuggets. Tip-off is 8 o'clock. The UW Badgers football team will face their rival, the Minnesota Golden Gophers, tomorrow. We've got a preview of that game on our website. You can read more at WPR.org. And the Packers have an interesting matchup on Sunday. They'll face the 7-3 LA Rams at 3:25.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. We want to take you into a studio session on a soundstage in London. A young, long-haired Paul McCartney is writing a new hit for the Beatles, but he's still kind of figuring out the words.
Sweet Loretta Mars, you thought you'd let him out.
Marsh isn't nice, it's a marsh.
Sweet Loretta Mary thought she was a woman, thought she was another man.
This is from a new documentary called The Beatles Get Back. It's a three-part series created from nearly 60 hours of previously unseen footage by a film crew given unprecedented access. The film centers around McCartney, John Lennon, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr as they attempt to write 14 new songs and plan what would become their last live show together.
Get back to where you once belong.
The trouble is you're on a harmony, then you go to the melody. So you should really go get back.
It's 1969, and the Beatles are in the doldrums. They've drifted apart creatively and personally.
We spoke with NPR music critic Ann Powers about the documentary.
Paul was listening to, like, a lot of soul music and kind of, like, old, I don't know, ballads and stuff. John is exploring noise and art rock with his future wife, Yoko Ono. And George has a stash of songs that nobody's heard, and he wants to make his own record. Ringo's just Ringo, you know. He's the steady beat.
1, 2, 3, 4. Loretta Martin thought she was a woman, but she was another man.
The Beatles Get Back is directed by Peter Jackson, best known for the Lord of the Rings trilogy. In this series, which lasts over 7 hours, it's the Beatles uninterrupted.
It is really an ambient experience, this documentary. I mean, like, it feels sometimes like hours are going by and they're just working on one verse of one song over and over again. But at the same time, I mean, what a privilege to watch even the most mundane elements of the collaboration among these total geniuses.
Yoko Ono, you mentioned Yoko Ono in most of the scenes sitting right next to John Lennon. How is she portrayed in this?
Well, there's a famous line that Paul says, and it's in this documentary, where he predicts that in future years, people will say that the Beatles broke up because Yoko was sitting on an amp during these sessions. It's absolutely true. She is glued to John's side. But I think this documentary really shows that Yoko Ono did not break up the Beatles, like, definitively, finally. Let's never talk about it again, because not only is she actually a great energetic presence, this kind of quiet, patient presence in the room. But also, you know, the real problem was with George. He was very unhappy. And that's all in this documentary. So let's just never say it again. Let's never say Yoko broke up the Beatles.
So we do notice the tension then on screen in this documentary, because, I mean, that's 69 is a kind of a fraught time for this band.
Oh, yes. I have to say, I love Paul McCartney. I am a Paul girl since I was, like, a child, but he's really overbearing. He has so much energy. He's just like writing a million songs, but he just pushes the band to the brink, and he's really mean, especially to George. And there's this whole drama around George, too. You know, they're dismissive of him, of his songs, of his spirituality. And at one point, he actually quits the band and just walks out.
So this thick tension, and how does the band resolve it?
Well, the most profound way they resolve the tension is just by playing music, and particularly blues and Chuck Berry songs, Dylan songs, you know, old kind of music hall numbers. And over again, at a moment when it probably would have been good to talk things out, instead, they play music. That is their love language, and we get to see that over and over again.
All right, let's take a listen. This is John Lennon breaking into a very familiar tune after a small disagreement.
You are my sunshine, my own sunshine. Make me happy and kind of great.
I mean, and how can anyone stay angry after someone starts singing that song?
Oh, yeah. And there is one factor that changes the trajectory for the Beatles during this documentary, and that is the presence of Billy Preston. Billy Preston is this American keyboardist and singer whom the band had signed to Apple Records. And he joins the sessions at a certain point, and the mood lightens up. They're creatively jazzed by his presence. The sound is amazing with his keyboard. I like to think about what would have happened if the Beatles had decided to stay together and made Billy Preston a fifth Beatle, you know, actually brought him into the band. We don't have that, but this documentary hints at the possibility.
You're in the group. Electric piano is such a great sound.
All this takes place months before the Beatles eventually do break up, and we know the direction the band is headed while watching this, but I mean, it just sounds like there's still so much joy in this film.
There is a lot of joy, and oftentimes it comes out of exactly those moments of tension and even sadness. I mean, sometimes a real gray cloud descends over the room. There's one point where Paul says, look, you know, I want this to be great because I know that we're going to walk out and this is probably the end. And it's just heartbreaking. But the whole film culminates in this rooftop concert, which we all know about. You know, it's a famous concert on the roof of the Apple building on Savile Row. And they play a short set and they are just locked in. And then the police come in and ask him to turn down the volume. But it reminded me of how much live music, it just makes magic in our lives. I almost got misty watching it. And then later, when they're listening to the playback of the live tracks, everyone in the room is just smiling and hugging. And it's just delightful. You know, this is a gift to us as listeners. And it makes that corny thing that the Beatles once said, all you need is love, feel real. And the music is the love.
Take 25.
That's NPR music critic Ann Powers. We've been talking about the new documentary series, The Beatles Get Back. Ann, thank you.
Thank you so much.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me. Speaking words of wisdom, let it be.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by B.J. Lederman. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Hannah Haynes. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll have news updates from NPR and WPR for you every hour. And there's always more news at WPR.org.
Support for WPR comes from SIFT EHR Consulting, dedicated to helping organizations fully utilize their healthcare software purchases by bridging the gap between workflows and raw data. More is at SIFTEHR.com.
Support comes from Kenosha County ADRC. Caravan is now offering expanded weekend hours Saturday and Sunday, 8 to 6. Rides available for elders and persons with disability, $4 one-way fares, reservations required one day in advance. Call 262-658-9093.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.